This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 203, the orb of These Things Happen. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Mike Schindler. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the writing team for the new series, and the many flavors of Star Trek Beyond that are headed to a screen near you. Then in the feature, we're joined by Mike Morrison and Brandon Shea Mutala to discuss the Deep Space Nine episode, Things Past. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Mike. It's great to have you back on the Ready Room for the first time in quite a long time co-hosting with me. But you've been very busy, I know, launching your new show, Stage 9.
Yeah, we just launched at the beginning of June, and it's a show about the people who make Star Trek, which I know sounds a lot like commentary Trek stars, but it's a very...
I was going to say, how is it different than what you were doing with John for the past 3-4 years.
And that's what people keep on saying. And, you know, I have to say, yeah, but no, I mean, we're taking a much different approach, you know, whereas the other ones were very sort of like formal and, you know, dense looks at creators, you know, careers. This is more about what's happening now, you know, who's making Star Trek now, because we have a whole new set of people who are working on Star Trek and, you know, looking at what they're doing, but then also looking at what they've done inside the franchise and all that stuff. So
yeah. Great. Well, it's got great reception so far, I know. And the topic of the first episode is something that I wanted to do today on the Ready Room as a news item, because we haven't had a chance to talk about this yet. And this is the writing staff for Star Trek 2017, because I think that you probably know more about these writers than most anyone on the network. You certainly know a lot more about them, other than Kirsten Beyer, who I've had the pleasure of talking to many times on Literary Treks. You know more about them than I do, for sure. So let's talk a little bit about who has been assembled to write this new series and why we should be excited about it.
Okay, we now know the full team as of right now. There's 9 people. Brian Fuller, of course, who we're all familiar with. Gretchen Berg and Aaron Harberts, who are a team. And they're also executive producers on the show. So I get the impression that they're basically Fuller's number ones.
Right.
Then there's Jesse Alexander, Nicholas Meyer, Kemp Powers, Aaron Colite. I could be pronouncing that wrong. I apologize. Kirsten Beyer and Joe Manosky.
Who are you most excited about?
I mean, it's got to be Nicholas Meyer, right? I mean,
yeah.
Did we ever think that we were going to see a Nicholas Meyer Star Trek anything ever again?
Right, right. But after Nick Meyer, because he came on board quite early, and we've talked a lot about him joining, as they've then assembled the larger writing team, who stands out to you? Who's someone that you didn't really expect, but now they're there, and because of the other stuff they've done, it really gets you excited about what they might do with Star Trek?
It's a really tough question, because I'm excited about all of them, but for all different reasons, and because they've all done such completely different things. And I think that's the key to what Fuller is doing here, what he has assembled, you know, this team that he has assembled is it's so diverse, and they come from so many, you know, different backgrounds and have done so many different types of things that I'm excited about all of them kind of equally for completely different reasons. But I guess the one which most recently just kind of surprised and shocked me, and I have to say I'm very excited about, is Joe Manosky, who, of course, has worked on three Star Trek shows in the past, Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager, and has written a lot of fan favorites. And I think, in addition to all of his, you know, standout episodes, which people love him for, he's also got this, you know, really big cult following of the people who like the really weird, crazy episodes with, you know, ideas which are rather high concept and out there and maybe don't always work, but you got to give him an A for effort. And I'm excited about what he's going to bring to the table, because I imagine we're going to see some really crazy stuff on this show now.
What I find interesting about the people they've assembled is that, I don't know, if you look at something like Enterprise, where Rick and Brannon, you know, it's been said they kind of wanted to distance themselves a little bit from the writing teams from past series, I think in an effort to try to get fresh ideas. But here you see people, of course, Nick Meyer, Brian Fuller, Manosky, you just mentioned, Kirsten Beyer, who writes the Voyager novels. You've got a lot of these writers who really have deep experience writing Star Trek. Does that give you any sense of a direction here in terms of what kind of stories they might tell, which timeline it might be set in, or just what CBS's goal might be in terms of making a series that really is aimed at the longtime fans?
Well, I think that that's something which, you know, I noticed, you know, Larry Nemechek saying online, which is, Brian Fuller has enough clout and his position in the industry is such that he doesn't need to do Star Trek, and he's not going to do it unless he gets to do it exactly the way he wants to do it. And in addition to being an extremely accomplished television producer who knows what it takes to make a television show, he's also as big a fan as any of us. So he's going to know what it takes to balance those two things to create a show which is, you know, universally appealing, and yet also something which the hardcore fans are going to love and latch on to and respect the past, as well as move it forward into, you know, modern television, you know, storytelling.
Storytelling, yeah. What do you think Alex Kurtzman's role is here, in that he's the one Abramsverse guy in this mix, where most everyone else is from the prime timeline?
I think that Alex Kurtzman's association with Star Trek is not nearly as important as his association with CBS. He has had numerous hits on CBS, and I think that the network trusts him as a producer to put out a, you know, quality piece of entertainment on a weekly basis. So I think having him on board is more to put the studio's minds at ease than it is anything else. Mm-hmm. But I do think that what he's going to contribute is going to be very interesting, because certainly coming from the Abramsverse, he's going to have that perspective, which I think, even if the show is not set in that universe, is a very important perspective to have, because as I'm known for saying, and everyone I think knows that I love those movies, you know, what those movies did, I think more than anything else, was bring Star Trek into, you know, the modern era of filmmaking in a way that a lot of the shows and movies prior to that had not. And I think that that's important to have. And, you know, if the various reports are to be believed, and I don't see any reason why they wouldn't be, Kurtzman is going to be directing the pilot himself. Okay. So that, I think, is going to be his biggest contribution. You know, I think that he's going to help, you know, with the concept, and probably, I'm guessing, with the pilot to some degree or another. And then he's going to direct the pilot and really establish the look and feel of this show. and then probably, you know, step back a bit, because he does have a huge movie which is coming out very soon after this show comes out, and I'm assuming that he's going to be spending most of his time working on that.
Mm-hmm. So you think we might see sort of an Abramsverse aesthetic, even if the show is set in the prime timeline?
It could be. I don't know. You know, he's had a lot of time with Abrams, both in movies and television and all that stuff. I don't know how much of Abrams' aesthetic he's going to adopt. He's only directed one movie of his own, and it was a little character drama called People Like Us. So I don't think that we have any real idea of what his aesthetic is, but I do think he certainly comes into things with the mindset of big blockbuster. You know, if you look at the movies that he's written, in addition to the ones for Abrams, he's written a bunch of stuff for Michael Bay. You know, he's written Zorro movies. Now he's directing The Mummy. So I think that he does have a really good sense of spectacle and what it takes to get that onto the screen. And I think that we could see that from him in his direction. For sure.
I'm just imagining on the new ship if Zorro were the security officer.
they're currently in production or pre-production on a futuristic Zorro movie, so you never know. Crossover.
Okay.
Hey, why not?
Talk about Kirsten Beyer a little bit, because as I said, I've had the pleasure of having her on Literary Treks with Matthew many times. I think she's been on 6 times. And she's always just really fascinating to talk to. And Voyager fans love her novels. And I think she's a great novelist. And she's been able to take, let's put it this way. So, you know, Matthew, my co-host on The Orb, and he and I used to do Literary Treks together. Not particularly a big fan of Voyager. Has a lot of criticisms about the way the characters were handled on the show. He loves the novels. He loves what Kirsten has done with those characters and with that storyline after the series ended. And I have seen how excited fans are about her being named to the writing team.
Yeah, you know, I'm not familiar with her work at all. I've never read any of her books. And in fact, for the first episode of Stage 9, where we talked about the writing staff, we actually brought on Charlene from To the Journey to make a little cameo and tell us why she's excited about Kirsten Beyer. And I did listen to episode 2 of Literary Treks, in which you guys interview Kirsten Beyer, and that I highly recommend it to anyone, because it really gave me a sense of who she is and what it is that she brings to the table as, you know, a writer and a fan and all that stuff. But to me, like, the thing that really stands out about that is the fact that Fuller doesn't seem to be concerned about people's resumes or titles or places in the industry or anything like that. What he sees with Beyer is someone who's a good writer who knows Star Trek. And the fact that she hasn't written anything for the screen is irrelevant to him. And I think that might be one of the reasons why fans are responding to this so strongly, because it's what they've all been thinking for years. I mean, the fact that, you know, Literary Treks is a show on the network shows how much people love these books. And lots of times, the mainstream media, the TV people and everything, they just completely ignore them, think that they're nothing but, you know, merchandise, really. And here Fuller is saying, no, this is legitimate. Her work is legitimate. And I want her to contribute to the canon. And I think that that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. And it makes me wonder, too, like, what the stories themselves are going to be. Like, what's the setting going to be? But, yeah, I think it's great that they are trying to assemble a team of the best writers and diverse writers as well. So we should get some really interesting stories.
I mean, one thing that I will say, and of course, this, I think, is something which would naturally occur because Fuller comes from Voyager, you know, more than any other show. But this is a very Voyager-heavy writing team. You know, in addition to Beyer and Fuller, of course, you've got Joe Manosky, who has written a ton of Voyager episodes, including both Scorpion and Year of Hell, along with Branham Braga. I mean, if you look at any poll or anything like that, there's you know, obviously some debate as to what the best episode of Voyager is, but the two that always come up are Scorpion and Year of Hell, and it's usually like a battle between those two for what the best one mm-hmm. is. He's written both of those. So I think if you're a fan of Voyager, even if this show has nothing to do with Voyager, which I'm assuming it won't, I think you'll be happy because the people who made Voyager great, or some of them, are working on this show, and, you know, that's really cool.
Yeah, I don't think there will be any connection to Voyager in the show, but the fact that we have these experienced prime timeline writers is something that gets me excited. Well, if people want to know more about the writers, again, I highly recommend everyone go listen to Mike's new show, Stage 9, hosted together with John Mills. And it's available in the master feed, of course, and also as a standalone episode and on the website. And you guys talk for, what, about 50 minutes or so about the writing team, right?
Yeah, we do. And after we talked about it, one of the people on the writing staff actually sent us a tweet and said, "You forgot two people."
Yeah, I saw that. But that news came out after you guys recorded there, didn't it? Of the two new writers.
That tweet is when the news came out. That tweet was literally the news.
That's what I thought. Yeah. That's what I thought. So you guys had already not only recorded, but edited, and we had set up and published, and then the news broke. So there's no way you could have covered them in episode one, but you're going to do it in episode two, right? Well,
not only that, but the only reason why the news broke is because someone on staff listened to episode one, so...
Oh, well. Okay. Well, that's really awesome.
it's extremely awesome. And
the power of Trek FM.
Yeah. And definitely, I'm sure by the time that this is posted, episode two will be out, and we will have definitely covered the other two writers in that episode. So, yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, one other topic to talk about in news before we jump into the feature. Let's talk about Star Trek Beyond, because you are an expert on theatrical things. That is your job. Screen formats, the way films are shot and such. And you were telling me about Star Trek Beyond being released in basically every format available. There are a number of big formats, IMAX, Dolby Cinema with Atmos surround sound, and Barco Escape, which is one I'm not familiar with. And how do you decide which format is right for you when you go to buy your tickets? You know, we face this a little bit with Star Wars The Force Awakens here, in that we could see it in 2D, we could see it in 3D, we also had 4D, where you've got like things that come out of the seats and like water coming from the ceiling and all kinds of stuff. I saw it in 2D myself, the whole family, we went to see that. My son went back later and watched it in 4D. So there are a lot of theatrical choices these days. So when it comes to Star Trek Beyond, tell us a little bit about how these different formats differ and maybe why you should choose one or the other.
Yeah, you used to be able to just go to a movie theater and watch a movie, but now no. I mean, just in terms of picture formats, there are 10 different ways that you can see Star Trek Beyond.
Wow.
So, and depending on the movie, it's not like, well, this is obviously the best one and it just works your way, you work your way down. Each movie is different because each movie is shot different, and lots of times things are imposed on filmmakers that they might not necessarily want to be imposed. So it gets to be really hard to determine. So in addition to 2D and 3D, there's IMAX, which is 3D most likely, and then IMAX Laser, and then Dolby Cinema and Barco Escape. And IMAX is the one that people always kind of think of because they think it's big, it's been around, people know what it means. And I honestly don't think that that is really the way to go, because IMAX has really kind of changed what it is and has sort of really become more of a brand than anything else these days. They've actually diminished their quality quite a bit by switching to digital over their film format, which is amazing. And in the process, they've kind of lost what it is that makes IMAX special. That being said, IMAX Laser is now a thing which exists in some parts of the country or the world. And if you are able to see the movie in IMAX Laser, I think that is the way to go for IMAX. But there's another laser format called Dolby Cinema. And the thing about laser, what makes it so great is the image is super bright but it's also super contrasty. So like when you get into like the dark areas, if there's like a dark scene, like it is pitch black. I mean, it looks amazing. The colors, everything. It's the most beautiful image you've ever seen on a movie screen, if you ask me. And the movie is being released in Dolby Cinema. I've never seen IMAX laser, but I have seen Dolby Cinema. I imagine they're pretty much the same thing. The one thing that I will say is most IMAX screenings are in 3D and most Dolby Cinema screenings are in 2D. And I guess that's the other question, 2D or 3D? Because lots of times 3D is a mixed bag. Lots of times it's something that the studio, like with Into Darkness, for example, J.J. Abrams did not want to shoot the movie in 3D or you know, convert the movie into 3D, but the studio wanted that extra cash, so they made him. But if you were to ask J.J., should we see this in 2D or 3D? He would say 2D, of course, you know? And Justin Lin has always been a big proponent of 2D, and this is his first 3D movie. And he has said that he thinks it's okay for this case because of the nature of the material, the fact that it's science fiction and, you know, epic space battles and everything. Whether he prefers 2D or 3D, I honestly don't know. I really, really, really want to know. But it sounds like 3D is not the end of the world in this case if you are stuck seeing a 3D movie. It may even be the way to go. But there is another format, a brand new format, which has barely ever been used, and it's called Barco Escape, where instead of
How do you spell Barco, by the way?
B-A-R-C-O. It's a Belgian company which makes projectors. They make very good projectors. Also, the keys which you use to unlock their projectors double as bottle openers.
Oh, really?
Because that's what they... that's how good they are at their design, you know, engineering and all that stuff. But... But Barco Escape is a very new format. There's only been one or two movies released in it, like The Maze Runner, where they have a screen in the front, but then also two screens on the side walls. So basically there's three screens which theoretically surround you. And for certain scenes in this movie, like the space battles and stuff, they are extending the action so that you will see, you know, ships and who knows what else flying around on all three sides and not just in front of you. Sounds great. Sounds like that's the way to go, right? Honestly, I'm not sure. I saw The Maze Runner in Barco Escape, and granted, the theater that I saw it in was not designed for this format, but it was underwhelming, to say the least. And the scenes which were extended, since it was all done in post, basically CGI, they looked not good. And I know that Abrams and Lin are supervising this format themselves, so it could be great. Who knows? It's been a couple of years. The technology has advanced. I'd be curious to see it just because it's so weird and out there. But if you want the ultimate experience, probably not the way to go on opening night or what have you.
Mm. And so, they probably charge you quite a bit more to get in, right?
They probably do, of course. You know, yeah. And they've actually, there's very few screens so far. They say that they're going to be adding more just for Star Trek Beyond. But as of right now, there's like a bunch on the West Coast, like a couple by New York or whatever. And then I think one or two in Belgium or Germany, just because that's where Barco is. Yeah. So it's going to be hard to find the movie in Barco Escape to begin with, but I don't know. It might be interesting just sort of as an oddity, but I probably wouldn't recommend that, you know, as your first time experience.
I feel like for these space battles, they should also put a screen on the floor and one on the ceiling, so you feel like you're just floating in space.
You know, why not, right?
Right. So finding an IMAX screen is easy because, like you said, they've really become more of a brand these days. I know our IMAX screens here in Tokyo, you know, the entire wall is like this gigantic blue IMAX, and it's really a, you know, heavily branded thing. For Dolby Cinema, on the other hand, are the theaters really branded heavily, or do you have to really pay attention to know if that screen is going to be Dolby Cinema with Atmos?
I think if you go to Dolby's website, you can find a list. They're few and far between. I mean, here in Chicago, we have one so far, and there's another one under construction. So they might be hard to come by at this point, but I would recommend trying to seek it out, you know, see what you can find, because it's really interesting. And if you can't find, you know, a movie, find the movie in one of these premium formats, honestly, you know, there's nothing wrong with seeing it just in plain old regular 2D or 3D, because in a lot of ways, I think maybe that is the way to go, because most of those theaters have, you know, perfectly fine, you know, digital projectors, you know, and everything like that. And I think no matter what, you're okay with this movie. But I think it is important to know what it is that these companies are promoting so that you have an idea of what you're getting into and why. Because if you're going to spend the extra money, you know, you should make it worth it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I kind of lean towards 2D stuff myself, especially with Star Wars. I'm glad I saw it in 2D because I think that gave the most authentic feeling of it being like an extension of the original films anyway.
And so. JJ certainly preferred 2D for that movie too. So
Yeah. All right. Well, very interesting information here, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about on the network. So before we jump into our feature today and talk more about Star Trek, I want to share with you a few clips from some of our other shows.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
The DNA of Star Trek fandom, and I've said it before, fandom existed, fandom enjoyed the show, but the main charge of fandom was to get the damn thing back.
To the journey!
He tweets out, you know, like, hey, walking around with my mobile emitter, you know, hashtag blessed. You know, it's just, I'm sure that's what he's doing.
Oh, gosh. yep, he's taking photos of his holographic non-dinner.
Warp 5.
The Romulans had their ship in Season 4 that had the holograms that made it look like any other ship. So you could theoretically retcon Minefield and say they were using that same technology back then.
Women at Warp.
Admiral Alan Alda came to visit Captain Coretta Scott King. Meanwhile, morale officer Beyonce is trying to deal with her new Weasley sweater, and
they're all partying at the First Contact party.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what else we're talking about in the Star Trek universe. We're talking about pretty much every topic that you love about Star Trek. We have, I think it's 25 shows now with the launch of Stage 9. So we cover every single aspect of Star Trek. And you can find them everywhere you get your podcasts, and iTunes, where we're a featured content provider. You can find our page there in the store at itunes.com/trekfm. You can also find us everywhere else, like Stitcher and TuneIn, Windows Phone, BlackBerry, SoundCloud. We're in Google Play Music now as well for you Android users out there. It makes it very easy for you to get the podcasts. And the Ready Room here, if you are streaming this from our website, for example, and you're a Spotify user, you can also find the Ready Room on Spotify. So check out all those shows and enjoy everything that the network has to offer. All right, Mike. Well, let's bring in our other Mike, Mike Morrison, as well as Brandon Shea Metalla for the feature and talk about the DS9 episode, Things Past. We've come to know Odo as a man who stands for justice, but he has a history with Cardassians that many Bajorans don't know about, and of course we don't know about either as the viewers, and that comes to the surface in the fifth season episode, Things Past, and today we're going to talk about this story, and to help us do that, we have with us Mr. Music himself, host of Melodic Treks here on the network, it's Brandon Shea Mutala, or B. Shea. Hey, B. Shea.
Hey, how's it going?
Going pretty well. just thinking about things that happened 7 years ago.
Yes, me too. Oh, man, I loved Bell Bottoms back when they came back in 2009.
I can see. I think that only happened in Canada.
It did, DJ. Yeah. The moose, they all had, these moose had these bell-bottom beaver pelts.
Now, that's quite a sight to see. Also joining us to discuss this episode today, from Matatrex, it's Mike Morrison. Hey, Mike.
Pleasure to be here, Chris. The cot felt so comfortable, I decided to stay.
That's right. You and Zachary just taking turns on there, and extended stay for you.
Extended stay.
Now, of course, in today's episode, we have two Mikes on here. And so, Mike Morrison, today we're going to call you M2 in honor not only of Lucille 2 on Arrested Development, but also because I think it makes you sound kind of like a secret agent, and I think Garrick would really appreciate that.
I am an international man of mystery.
Very good.
Well, I just have to correct you there, Chris. We actually have six mics. Like, I'm talking into a mic, and you're talking into a mic. And
oh, that's true. That's true. Okay. Well, I'm not going to name all of our actual microphones. That'll be way too confusing for me. All right. Well, before we get into the discussion, as we always do, here's a quick synopsis of things past, in case you haven't seen this in a while. While returning from a conference on Bajor, the runabout carrying Sisko, Odo, Dax, and Garrick passes through a plasma storm. When the ship reaches Deep Space Nine, Dr. Bashir finds that all four are comatose. But this isn't really the case for Sisko, Odo, Dax, and Garrick, who find themselves on Terok Nor 7 years earlier during the occupation. They're a little bit confused at first, but soon they learn that they are displaced in time. But not only are they displaced in time, they're also displaced in body. They are Bajorans. As the story unfolds, a lot of stuff happens between that and the end of the episode, but basically, as the story unfolds, we follow the actions of Security Chief Thrax as he investigates and sentences three Bajorans for the attempted assassination of Gul Dukat, which happens there in Quarks. The very three Bajorans whose bodies Sisko, Garrick, and Odo are inhabiting are the ones who Thrax believes planted the bomb and tried to kill Dukat. The twist is that 7 years ago, Odo was the security chief aboard Terok Nor, not Thrax. Thrax was the chief prior to Odo. So we're seeing the story through the eyes of these characters as if Thrax is there, but it's really Odo looking at himself. And in the end, Odo owns up to his role in the execution of three innocent men, and Sisko, Odo, Dax, and Garrick all wake up in the infirmary back on DS9 in the proper time period. And then there's a little coda with Kira, which is very important, and we'll talk about that at some point today, I'm sure. So that's the basic rundown of the episode. So let's go on with our initial thoughts. So, Biche, what are your first thoughts here on Necessary Evil? I mean, things past.
Yeah, I was very confused going into this because I put the disc in and I sat down and I was really expecting Necessary Evil because I got confused with the titles for a minute there. And then I'm like, wait a minute. No, this isn't Necessary Evil. What is this? What is going on here? And
that's the second season episode where we visit Terok Nor with Odo.
Yeah. So going into this episode, it was, I've done a Deep Space Nine watch a couple of times now. Like, I've seen the entire series probably five times. So, and then I watched this episode twice now. In preparation for this, I've seen this episode probably seven times now, and I completely forgot about this episode. Like, watching it again now, I didn't know how it was going to end. I didn't know what was coming up. I couldn't remember anything about this episode at all. And so, expecting Necessary Evil and watching this, like, I was really captivated by this episode on this rewatch. And then I watched it again this morning, and I'm like, this episode is really good. And I don't know if I enjoyed it so much because I was unprepared for it, but I really enjoyed this episode this time around. Like, holy smokes, like this is definitely going to be a memorable one for me going forward.
What about you, M2?
Well, Chris, season five is really a different season, I think, for Deep Space Nine. Of course, this episode is two episodes, I think, removed from arguably one of the best Star Trek episodes of any series, Trials and Tribulations. So
I thought you were going to go the other direction because it's too removed from Rapture.
Yes, yes, indeed. And this whole season is so largely episodic, which is not really what most fans remember about Deep Space Nine. And another thing about this particular episode is that it's a single plot. There's no B plot. There's no C plot going on. So it's really different. But it is this really curious look at Odo's past as chief of security on the promenade during the occupation. And it explores, I think, some really interesting dark chapters in his history. It feels very Shakespearean to me, kind of Macbeth, McOdo, I don't know. It has all the things I think that make a really great episode of Star Trek and really develops Odo's character. I think it's an absolutely necessary episode in understanding Odo. The thing that really kind of disappoints me about the whole episode is Kira's reaction at the end of the story. And I'm sure we'll get into that because, as Bichet's already mentioned, you know, the season two episode in which we get to visit their relationship during the occupation. But overall, I think it's a really strong, fascinating moral play.
Okay, that's an interesting point. So I'm curious later to discuss her reaction to him at the end and why you feel that way about it. Mike, how about you?
I think this episode is extremely good. It starts off as one of those things which you kind of think is going to be cool, but ultimately, you know, insignificant, you know, lots of the time where you see sort of like an alternate view of what you're used to looking at, you know, where I mean, quite literally in terms of the way they shoot the station. But, you know, here you're looking at like another time period and all this stuff, and you're seeing the characters in a different way. And you think, well, that's going to be kind of interesting. And at the end of the day, we all will have learned a lesson, which we will take on to the next episode, unless you're not watching them in order in syndication. But when we get to the end with that scene with Kira, you really realize that they have changed Odo's character substantially, and they've changed the dynamic between those characters in particular, and it really is very essential to the overall show, and it really packs quite a punch. I think it's kind of masterfully done. It's a great episode.
It's interesting that later in the season, we get a similar reaction at the end of Children of Time when Kira has this discussion with Odo, and of course she's also disappointed in his actions there. So this sets up a chain of sort of tense interactions between them as their relationship gradually evolves to what it becomes at the end of the series. So it's very interesting when there. Before we get into the meat of those relationships and things that happen on the station, let's just talk about a look at Terok Nor first and how the station looks and what life was like there. People always talk about Deep Space Nine as being that grittier Star Trek, which I think is sort of not an accurate way to describe the show. But if the station had looked like it did under Cardassian occupation, maybe dark and gritty would have been correct. Mike, as the film guy here, how do you feel about, you know, the cinematography and what LeVar Burton did as a director and how this time period of the station is portrayed?
I think it's really interesting. And this is something that I was thinking about while watching the episode and how, I mean, they do this type of thing a lot, but usually it's supposed to be invisible, you know, like reusing a set as like a different location or that kind of thing. And you don't really think about it because you're not supposed to. That's how good they are at it, is you're not thinking about it. But here, you know, you really do have to kind of stop and think, wait a minute, this is supposed to be the same place just 7 years prior. And I think what they're able to do just with a little bit of lighting, really, more than anything, I mean, sure, some you know, set decoration as well, but with just a little bit of lighting to completely change the look of these locations, which we are, at this point, intimately familiar with, I think is really interesting. And it really does say a lot about how much the station has changed in those 7 years. I mean, at one point, I have to say, I was thinking, like, why don't the Cardassians like lights? You know, you would think that they would, you know, light things like normal people, right? I mean, but whatever, it's all good. But, you know, I mean, it's art, and thematically it works really well. I think that it's kind of a standout in that regard, you know. I actually did not look, but I'm assuming that Jonathan West was the cinematographer here, as he was for most of Deep Space Nine. And he's fantastic as a cinematographer. And, you know, this is some really good work on his part for sure. And LeVar Burton is a hell of a director on the whole. I'm regularly impressed by the episodes that he directs in all the shows.
Well, something that you said there, Mike, like if you go back to the episode from season two, The Wire, right, yeah, where we get to know the information about Garak, like Garak is saying how it's always too bright here and it's always too cold. Mm-hmm. Like the Cardassians, they must have a different photosensitivity in their eyes to keep it that much darker, but it's been mentioned. And so it's nice to see that follow through, and that's how they kept the station. But, you know, thinking about that, the station actually has a warmer feel to it. Like with all these bodies and how packed it is and whatnot and how grimy and dirty, like I can feel the warmth watching the episode as well. So it's clearly in their comfort zone and stuff. But just with a little bit of lighting, like you said, and set design, like it really, really packs a punch. That's for sure.
Yeah. You can feel the shift from it being an ore processing facility during the occupation to being a home for people.
Definitely.
Once the Federation comes in, they clean the place up and they make it feel like a place where people want to live. And they have a job to do, which is not processing ore at that point. So it's not dirty and grimy. And I don't know how they keep things so clean in the future, but somehow they do if they want to. At least the Federation has great technology. Maybe maybe Dyson is involved in that. I don't know.
Roomba.
Space Roomba.
Space Roomba.
You see them running down the corridors all the time, yes.
Is that what those things are in Star Wars? Those little black things that go around?
The mouse droids?
Yeah, those Roombas.
Yeah. Do those clean? Is that what they're for?
Yes.
It would make sense. They're like those little sucker fish in your aquarium, right?
Yeah.
That just go around.
I'm sure they've perfected the nanotechnology that we see in Next Gen and, you know.
Yeah.
It's all good.
Maybe Wesley's responsible for it all.
He is a genius, right?
The other interesting thing about this part of the episode, this aspect of the episode, seeing life on the station, is that it does add to the mythology. And I guess you said this actually, Mike, on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
Of the Cardassian occupation and the Bajoran culture, the life that they had. You can understand how oppressed they were, why they were fighting against it, and the hardship that they faced. And then, as is pointed out in this episode by Thrax when he's talking to Odo, the occupation has lasted 50 years. He thinks it's going to last 50 more. But if you imagine a culture living under this kind of oppression for half a century and what that would do to the culture, knowing that background and actually being able to feel it a little bit, so you're not just hearing about it like you are through most of DS9, but you're actually seeing people in that situation, it helps you to frame the actions of the Bajorans that you see in other episodes and why they have such a hatred for the Cardassians. And it's just important in adding depth to the overall story element of DS9.
DS9 has a unique advantage when it comes to Star Trek in this regard, in that, you know, lots of times we hear about, you know, for example, Picard on the Stargazer, or, you know, Worf, you know, growing up on Earth or whatever. But just from a practical standpoint, even if you have like a story device like this, you can never really see that because you can't afford to build that. Although I guess Picard did have that with Tapestry. But, you know, generally speaking, you really can't get that. But with Deep Space Nine, so much of the history of the show and these characters is tied into the place that you really can, just through some simple lighting tricks and everything, you know, take viewers back there and set a story in that time period. And it adds so much to the show. I mean, one of the standouts to me here in this regard is seeing Quark and just the way that he acts when he's in a different position in terms of society, really. And mm-hmm. It really adds so much to that character because he's not being stifled by the Federation. In a sense, you're seeing who he truly is in a way that you normally wouldn't be. And I think that that's really interesting. So yeah, it's cool that they're able to do that.
Well, in the case of Quark, Mike, for me, it really makes me appreciate the character development that takes place with him, seeing him during the occupation and the way he conducted himself and going to the period in Deep Space Nine when the Dominion occupied the station. And now it's kind of, you know, throwback Thursday for him, but he's not comfortable with it. And he wants to go back to root beer and, you know, the Federation effervescence. And so I appreciate that character development a little bit. And the other thing, not just the lighting, but also the way they used wardrobe in this instance to kind of set the scene. You really felt like it was an occupied labor camp, simply by looking at the wardrobe and the way they used textiles, and it really kind of gave it a Nazi concentration camp type feel to it.
Yeah, you got it. There was something that I'm trying to put into a coherent thought into words in my head with this episode. So, like, jumping the timeline on this episode a little bit, we find at the end that it's like this weird link. And, you know, with the way that Thrax turns into a changeling in the episode, the way that I see it and watching it twice back to back is that, so it's Odo trying to separate himself from the past and trying to come to terms with dealing with what he had to do in that time. So is this affecting some of the characters as we're seeing them by being painted through Odo's point of view? Because the way that Thrax is talking to Quark in, like, over the Dabo table is almost how Odo talks to Quark, right? So as I'm watching this episode and watching it, like, back to back the second time, I'm watching it. Well, is that actually a conversation that Odo had with Quark 7 years ago? And because he wants to disassociate himself with these events, he's putting Thrax in this position now. So, yeah. Well, sorry. So, like, with Quark coming up to them and saying, you know, because when Quark comes up to him and says, I'm going to use you guys, I'm going to pay you a slip of lat, and I'm going to give you 2 5-minute breaks for 12-hour work. So, like, that is a completely different Quark than we know. And he's, like, reveling and taking advantage of this labor. Is that something that Quark would have done? Or is it painted through this lens of how Odo sees Quark?
Well, I think in terms of Thrax, my reading of it, I have my reading of what I think they're doing with the episode and then what it could be if you extend it further out, and the fact that Thrax is a changeling here. I think that, so Thrax wasn't actually there,
right?
He was already gone at this point, and Odo was the security chief. I think that Odo is seeing his own actions through Thrax. So the things that Thrax says and the things that he does, those are the things that Odo said and that Odo did 7 years ago. So it's not actually Thrax in the first place.
Right.
So in that case, it is Odo. The part where you go beyond that is, and you don't realize this until you get near the end of the episode and you find out that Thrax is a changeling, and then Bashir gives the whole explanation about how there was this kind of residual traces of morphogenic enzymes in Odo's brain, although I don't know how you have a brain if you're a changeling, because you form one, I guess. So you're.
But he's not a changeling anymore, right?
Yeah, he's got one.
But he's not a changeling anymore. That's right. So in his brain, and at this point, you know, Sisko says during the episode, at this point, the founders don't know about the wormhole 7 years ago, right? Not fifth season DS9, but 7 years ago. So why would there be a changeling there in the first place? Mm-hmm. But whatever the runabout passes through, it activates this thing, and Bashir explains that Odo is kind of reaching out, trying to find other changelings. And we do know that 100 were sent out, so apparently there is this changeling around. But what I also feel like could have happened, or they could have taken the story in this direction, is that this is part of the founders making their point to Odo, now that he's a solid, he's being punished, right? And he's had other sins in his past. And here was an opportunity for them to make him face up to something else that he did in the past and come to terms with that. And because of the Great Link, and this is a discussion that Matthew and I have had on the Orb a number of times, what what is the Great Link and what are the changelings? So the way that I see the Great Link, I believe is how I feel about it at this point after discussing it so many times, is that ultimately the Great Link is like one single entity. And pieces of this entity can come off and exist independently, and Odo is one of those. It's sort of like that creature that we see in Voxola on Enterprise, where this one little piece, you know, they have to take it back, and it reunites with the rest of the entity. And we have forests on Earth that look like forests, but they're one tree, right? And they stretch, I forget the exact name of them, but they're one entity. Therefore, Thrax, the changeling that's Thrax, could already know all these things that happened to Odo in the past via the Great Link, and therefore this is the way of the Great Link forcing Odo to relive these events from his past and face up to these past sins. And by doing so, it advances his character and it maybe moves him a step closer to his eventual return to being a changeling and not being a solid. Because the final scenes, when he finally steps in and he says, I'm not going to let this happen again, and then everything changes, and then Sisko, Dax, and Garak are in their normal clothing, and they look across, and then they see the execution, and they see Odo standing there. And then when Odo finally admits everything that happened and that it was him, they disappear for a moment, and he still lingers, and then he disappears. So that's, I don't know. I don't think that's where the writers were going with it. But in my mind, it makes sense that it could be this greater thing involving the Great Link and a lesson to him.
Well, we know that Odo was judged by the changelings. And at least in my mind, I see this as being a residual of that judgment that was imposed upon him. Odo has always been kind of this self-righteous character, and that self-righteousness towards his own kind, I think, is part of what he was judged for. So I think, Chris, you're absolutely right in that if he was judged in the Great Link, certainly his own self-righteousness and this particular shadow, this black mark from his past, I think was probably one of those things that was introduced to him as, well, you know, look at you, Odo, you're not so perfect. And Bisha, I think you're exactly right in that Thrax is Odo, and the way he sees Quark, the way he talks to Quark, I think that was an actual conversation. In fact, everybody commented, you know, hey, you're not the only one who kept Quark on it on their toes. So I think they recognized something in Thrax that was very Odo-like. And so I think this was just a residual of that traumatic experience in the Great Link, being judged for, among other things, not just killing a changeling, but his own self-righteousness and his judgmental attitude towards his own people.
Yeah, like, because, like, I didn't like this Quark, and I know you're not supposed to, but it's like watching this Quark is like, this is a person who's okay with the slave labor that's going on, right?
Quark?
Yes, that's what I see, because when he comes up to the fence and is like, you guys are lucky, I've picked you, I'll give you this much slips to come and do work for 12 hours, and you get 2 5-minute breaks, and that's it. And, you know, the way he's also talking in that scene, he's like, I don't want these crystals because the Bajorans can't afford them, and whatnot. And yes, we know that he's concerned with profit and stuff.
But I think he was making that up.
Oh, really? I believe that story myself, but...
No, I mean, I think the Bajorans can't afford them, but I think that...
No, that
I don't believe Quark that he wasn't actually trying to get the crystals. I think he was just making up a quick excuse about
clear himself.
But he's okay with the slave labor. Like, he just walks up to a fence and hires these three people and gives them these petty wages, you know, 2 5-minute breaks over a 12-hour period. And it's like, that makes me uncomfortable because I love Quark so much, you know?
Well, I think it was Quark, Bisha, because one of the things that we kind of discover about Quark, especially early on in Deep Space Nine, is he's kind of a soldier of fortune, and he will, you know, he will side with whoever's in charge, and he will say whatever he's got to say to survive. And he didn't really, at least in my opinion, become the Quark that so many of us really got to know and love until he fell under the influence of the Federation. He was fundamentally changed because of his exposure to the Root Federation. Beer. Root beer.
No, Quark is the Apple user who will suddenly switch to Microsoft because the Surface tablet was $20 cheaper.
I was thinking the same thing, honestly. Like, I was sitting there watching that first scene with him where he, you know, hires them, and thinking, like, because they have that line where they say, you know, if we kill him, will that change the timeline? And they're like, let's find out, you know. And, you know, it's meant to be a joke, but at the same time, like, I'm sitting there watching his actions and thinking, like, yes, I know that he's changed a lot. I mean, he has a huge arc over the course of this show. But if you see that, you know, in the same way that Kira questions Odo when she finds out about his past, and this is something which he has felt extremely guilty about for that entire time, it's like, I don't know how I would react to Quark when I got back to the future, you know? I think I would be like, you know what? I didn't like you to begin with, but now I really just can't stand to be around you, you know, and maybe that's not fair. Maybe that's one of the things that this episode is about, but I think it's interesting that it's kind of left unchecked. It's almost like they felt like, yeah, this is where he would be. And it's a kind of an interesting peek at that. And I think that Armin Shimerman, who, you know, is very outspoken about, you know, sort of taking Quark seriously, you know, and not, you know, making him just comic relief. I think that his portrayal is fantastic because he's like, look, I'm going to show these people, the audience being the people, you know, what Quark really is or what he really was, you know. But I feel like they kind of dropped the ball by not having any sort of wrap-up to that, you know, once they get back to the station, because while this may be stuff that they knew, you know, just from knowing Quark and knowing the history of the situation, it's different when you see that exploitation firsthand, you know?
Yeah.
It's hard to just go back and start joking with this guy, you know, this your bartender, essentially, after you see him do things like that. You know what I mean?
I think it's really easy to forget the Quark of season one in episodes, and I know it's no one's favorite episode, but Move Along Home, where he will just take complete advantage of the Wadi or whoever in order to make a buck and to put himself in a position of profit. And we forget that Quark, but even that Quark was somewhat evolved from the Quark he was when the Federation came aboard the space station.
And I guess what's interesting when you think about it, season one is closer to the story that we're seeing here than it is to season five, you know, where this show mm-hmm. takes place in the overall continuity.
Right. Yeah. Because you'd only be 2 years after this occupation period. Yeah. Right.
So, Mike, there, just because you brought it up there with Move Along Home, I just wanted to say, Alan Moraine, count to four, Alan Moraine, then three more.
Thank you, Biche. Thank you. Now we can continue on with the show. Otherwise, I was just going to stop here until someone did that.
Move Along Home is not a bad episode. I'm going to say
that.
I agree.
Okay? It is not a bad episode.
Well, if Matthew Rushing were here, I think he'd say it's just time to move along.
Now, he did say that when we did a recent show. But yes. I will tell people, yeah, go back to the Orb. I don't remember the episode number off the top of my head. It's fairly early on, but it's called She's Really Good with the D20s, I believe. And we cover Move Along Home on the Orb as if it were a TOS episode. And it makes complete sense in those wrappings, and it's a wonderful episode. So I encourage everyone to go back and listen to that episode of The Orb. All right. Well, let's talk about we talked about Quark a bit right here, and the person who said, if we kill him, would it change the timeline, is Garak. And so let's talk about Garak just a little bit. If we gain anything from this episode with regard to his character, he thinks that he's going to be able to get them off the station because he has these Cardassian codes. His distaste for Gul Dukat certainly comes out in this episode, however.
I love Garak. He is so awesome. Like, so watching it again and just knowing how Garak messes with people all the time, that opening scene where they're talking about this conference that he was on and where he's like justifying the Cardassians' actions and talking about like, well, I thought they would be more receptive to all this opinions that I had and stuff. And it's like, is he messing with them or does he believe this? I just...
Yeah, and you don't know with Garak, no. Really, right?
It's such a great scene because he's like, oh, if they would have... Like, Sisko's like, I thought they bent over backwards to be polite to you. He's like, yeah, but they gave me a name tag that says former Cardassian oppressor. You know, like, oh my goodness, what a great scene. Like, I want just 45 minutes of Garak talking. Like, that's it. That's all I want.
Like my dinner with Garak.
Yes, great. My dinner with Garak.
Breakfast at Garak's. I was picturing, I've been to so many conferences and conventions, so when he said that, I really was picturing him being there, mingling with everyone with that name tag that says former Cardassian oppressor Garak.
Yeah, I don't know who's responsible for dreaming up his character, but he's just one of my favorite Star Trek characters, period. And this definitely, I think, goes a long way towards developing his dislike of Gul Dukat. I think it does a lot towards kind of adding to the mystery, the anthology of whatever his past was with the Obsidian Order, because he does. He really thinks that if he just throws a couple codes out, he can get them all out of there. And of course, they don't even realize that they're trapped inside this morphogenic transference of Odo's. But, you know, I've got some codes. And once again, how does a simple tailor come up with these kind of codes? I'm going to add pickpocket.
I don't look Cardassian. There's no Cardassian DNA in this body I'm inhabiting, but I've got codes.
And
so I'm going to get us out of here.
And we found out we can add pickpocket to his rap sheet.
Okay, so there's something else that I want to mention here, and it's with what Garak says, where he's like, okay, all I have to do is say these few code words, and they're going to know that I'm actually a Cardassian Obsidian Order agent, basically, and not a Bajoran as they're looking at him. So again, this goes back to what I was saying earlier, where, okay, at the end of the episode, did any of these three people, like Dax and Garak and Sisko, actually partake in these events, or was this all in Odo's head? Because again, that almost seems like something of how Odo perceives Garak, because that is just so ludicrous that Garak would even be able to just walk. I understand that it ended up being in the head at the end, but for him to be like, oh, I'm going to walk up to somebody and just mumble these three words and they'll know I'm an Obsidian agent. Right? And then,
so
the way at the end when Sisko and them are talking in the jail cell, when they escape and come back in and they're like, oh, Odo, it all comes back to you. Like, it doesn't sound like them. I don't know if you know the scene I'm talking about, but it's like right at the end.
Okay, so let me be clear on what you're asking here, because I want to talk about the timeline concept a little bit as well. So you're saying, when you say, did they actually participate in these events, you don't mean like time travel and did they actually participate. You mean, were they simply unconscious the whole time and all of their actions and all of their statements, all of this was generated inside Odo's head? It wasn't a shared experience. It was just Odo's experience.
Right, because they didn't say at the end. So Bashir says, you reached out and you had this thing. So, but did any of them actually have this dream along with Odo? Or was it Odo?
I think that the fact that when Garak is punched and his nose bleeds, I think that is the signal that they all did participate in the experience.
Yes, you're right. Yep.
Also, we see scenes with Dax separated from the rest of them. You know, we see scenes without Odo.
Okay,
And Odo would not have been able to know what was happening there either.
Yep. So.
But it is a really interesting idea, right? That it could be just one person.
Okay. Yeah, but you know, again with Garak, so going up and being like, yeah, I can just say this one or two words, they're going to know, you know, and then the fact that he gets punched in the face, and the way that I see it is to simply take that tool from that Cardassian. He took a punch to the face to get that tool.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's some crazy stuff that the character is doing. Like, Giz Garak is, like, so deep.
He would do that. I mean, I can definitely see him taking the punch, you know? Maybe you could make a case for some of the other stuff, but I could definitely see him taking a punch in order to get that. I mean, that's like a metaphor for his entire life, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
And it's not, this isn't the first time we see Garak offering up some of his expertise to get himself out of a tight spot. So I think it is very Garak. I think he was a participant in those events. I think it was implied by the fact that they were all unconscious at the same time. And certainly, as Christopher mentioned, you know, Garrick's nose bleeding. Again, it kind of all goes back to Move Along Home, where, you know, we have evidence that they are actually participants in this game, if you will.
But Move Along Home is different, I think, because in Move Along Home, it really was a game. So
yes,
their lives were never actually in danger, although they didn't know that.
They didn't know that.
But the Wadi knew that. It was just a game, and they're going to reappear afterwards. It's fine. Here, I wonder if Odo had not unraveled the mystery at the end, if he had not stood up to the Cardassians and then finally owned up to the fact that it was he who did this in the past, and they had actually executed Garak, Dax, and Sisko, would they have died? Would it have sent a shock through their system, and would they have died on the biobeds in the infirmary?
Well, Chris, I think that's what makes this such an interesting episode, because they leave you wondering that. And there are very high stakes to this episode. There's a possibility that one or all of these characters may not make it to the end. I think that's what adds to the whole suspense. It's one of the things that makes this such a good episode.
So this was at the point when they were in contract negotiations with Avery Brooks, and they weren't sure if he was going to come back for episode 9, right?
if we assume that Matrix technology is in keeping with Star Trek technology, that they take place in the same continuity, then yes, they would die.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to assume that the Matrix is real in order to.
Well, now that you reminded me about the nosebleed, which I forgot about, I do believe that. Yeah, they've gotten a shot by the phasers at the end there. Then yes, they would have died. So, this was a good episode.
Well, if you think back to Voyager with the thaw, the shock of, like, thinking that you're being beheaded when you're in that that experience with the clown was enough to kill you, right? It's a shock through your system. And even though you're not actually being beheaded, the shock would cause you to die. You would literally be scared to death.
It's such a great episode. Like, what? I can't believe I cannot remember this episode prior to this. Like, I watched this episode and I'm just like, what is this episode? Like, it's like I just discovered a new Deep Space Nine episode yesterday. Like, this is just awesome.
That's a thing which runs through Deep Space Nine. I mean, Deep Space Nine is easily my favorite show, and yet it's the one which I have the hardest time, like, naming episodes or even, you know, giving recaps of episodes, because it feels like it's all part of one big thing, you know? And I mean, the fact that this is informed by what has come before and this informs what comes later, you know, just kind of like speaks to the show on the whole and how great it is. That integration, you know, that's why this episode, I think, is so effective. I mean, here we are having a conversation about whether or not Garak would do these things. I don't think that we'd have that conversation if the show didn't do such a good job of building these characters, you know, over the span of 7 years. And I think that this is a key block in that building.
And yet it's still so episodic.
Yeah. You can totally just turn it on if you've never seen it. And, you know, you might not know why Odo is so affected by this, because you don't know the geopolitical landscape or whatever it is, but it still works as a 45-minute story. Yeah.
Yeah, it does. Talking about the timeline just a little bit more, what do you think about the approach to taking us back to this time period? Because the writers had said that they wanted to do an episode where they revisited Terok Nor again because Necessary Evil was quite popular, but they didn't want to do a memory flashback show, and they also didn't want to do a time travel show. So this is how they got around it. And to say this is not a memory flashback show is sort of tenuous because it sort of is, although I know what they mean in that it's not just simply, here, I'll tell you a story, and then you go back to the time period, and then you come back, and hey, wasn't that a great story? You know, there's more to it than that. So what do you think about the nuance of the approach?
I think that honestly, it's more distracting than just saying, let me tell you a story, you know, or whatever, because it feels so forced in a lot of ways. It's, you know, it's like you can feel the hand of the writers there saying, like, we want to tell this story that takes place in the past, so let's make up this crazy thing, you know, in order to get us there, and, you know, tech the tech, you know, to the extreme. And it's like, just tell the story, guys. No one cares. No one cares about your, you know, your fake science. Just tell the story.
It is sort of teching the tech in this case, right? Like, what I love about Trials and Tribulations is that they didn't tech the tech to get the crew back into that episode in the 23rd century, because it was already established that the Bajorans have these orbs, they have unusual powers, they happen to be transporting the Orb of Time. The Orb of Time throws them back. There's no explanation as to how the Orb of Time throws them back. We just accept that, well, it's an orb, so these things happen, and then you just tell the rest of the story, right? But here you've got all this thing about, you know, neural activity and what this remnant of changeling matter in Odo's brain and all this other stuff in order to get them there.
You should change the name of that to the, I just found the Orb of These Things Happen.
The Orb of These Things Happen. There probably is one of those too. They're very popular. Bajorans, they wear them on necklaces. They have like a little one. And, you know, if you're late to work, if you screw up a job, whatever happens to you, you just pick it up, you just dangle it and shrug your shoulders. And
yeah,
when people go, all right, I get it.
Yeah, I just can't wait till they find the Orb of Pumpkin Pie.
Oh, man, you and your pumpkin pie.
but you know, this is Star Trek, and it's certainly not the first time that they have gone to the utter ridiculous nth degree.
It's not, although DS9 tends to avoid that.
Yeah, but it does it occasionally, and I think as a Star Trek fan, I just expect it from time to time. Some ridiculous explanation for why these things happened beyond something simple like the Orb of These Things Happened. You know, give me some kind of over tech or crazy explanation for how these events came to be. I'm a Star Trek fan. I can take it.
Technobabble never bothered me with Star Trek because I always interpret it as like it's the MacGuffin of the episode, you know, like they're going blah, blah, blah. And I always assume that, you know, 400 years from now, if I lived, I would understand what they were talking about if I went through Starfleet Academy. But I don't need to understand, because then they turn around and say, oh, it's because, oh, you mean it's just like this. And then they give you like the complete layman's terms. So
it's true. But as Star Trek went on, by the time you get to the end of Voyager, I think that technobabble became such a crutch that it actually sometimes created a barrier to the story. Because if, like me, if you watch the stories largely for social commentary and character interactions and character growth and relationships, sometimes if you go overboard with the technobabble, it interferes with your ability to follow the rest of the story. Not all the time, but sometimes it becomes a little bit much.
It's
I think that's why they saved it for the end of the episode.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Well, but it's one of those, you know, there's two ways to go about it or two reasons for using it. One would be because, like, oh, well, we want to get them back on, you know, the station where Kirk and Spock were with the Tribbles, you know, where in which case, yeah, okay, you use some sort of explanation in order to get them back there. But to say, like, we want to tell a story in this time period and we just don't want to do a flashback episode, I mean, that seems like you're going one step further to saying, you know, it's not that they want to have their characters back there. It's that they wanted, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. They just wanted to show the time period. They just wanted to show what it was like without any, yeah. And I didn't like thinking myself either. I think it's kind of hokey where it's like, it was this dream the whole time. Like I would, you know, when Star Trek season two comes around for 2017, I want it to be a season of the occupation. Like I would just love to see Tarek Nor for like a whole season.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought it was kind of hokey at the end, how they wrapped it up with this. It was this dream that didn't happen, but did because you're still part changeling and stuff. And it's like, yeah, whatever. But it was still a great episode.
I think if they were making Deep Space Nine today, they would do like they do on Arrow, where you would get these scenes of Tarok Nor interwoven into the current story. This is a flashback episode. I'm techno babble aside, flashback, no flashback. It's a flashback story.
Man.
Do you think that they could, I guess they could have done it at the time that this was made, but especially now they maybe could do this, is just tell the story in this time period. Like, don't set it up. Just start the story and you're back there. You know, I mean, Lost did that with a few episodes that I can remember where suddenly you're with a character that was in the past and there's no explanation as to why you're telling that story. You just understand that this is the character's past. In the fifth season of DS9, you know about Tarek Nor, you know about the occupation, you know that Odo was the security chief under Dukat. So if you just open the episode and you're there and you're just telling the story, now maybe you wouldn't have Sisko and Dax and Garrick there, and maybe that's the issue that you need to have these cast members there for some reason. But if you told a bottle show about Odo himself, you could just go right into it.
Chris, I think it was necessary, though, to have the other characters there because part of what takes this sort of a step beyond just a flashback episode is Odo is exposed now. They're there. True. Seeing these events unfold as they did 7 years ago, and now his sin has been exposed. His sins found him out, and it's not a secret anymore. Everybody knows it now.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah.
It's necessary for this story, but if they went into it with the mindset that they could just tell a story in the past, they could have told a different story, which, you know, might have been equally as good or different or whatever. And as far as like a precedent being set, I mean, the X-Files did it at least once right around this time. There was like an episode which took place like a few years before. And it was interesting because it was like a story that, you know, was just in the past, but they would layer in these little details where you're like, what? Like the thing that I remember is like Mulder had a wedding ring on and they never mentioned it or anything like that. But it's like a character thing where it's like that changes your perception of this character. And I think you could do that in the same way that this episode does that. You know, it changes your perception of Odo, or like we were saying, Quark, by seeing what they were like 7 years ago. And even if you don't, even if none of the other characters find out about it, the fact that the audience knows can really kind of, you know, shed some light on these people.
Well, they did that in Fringe as well. In season four of Fringe, they didn't know if they were going to come back from season five, but even still at the end of it, they had this future episode that took place, you know, like 20 years in the future. And that's, they were setting up season five, but they didn't know that they were coming back for a season five. So they still did this episode that had nothing to do with anything else. And yeah, it would have worked if we just had this one episode taking place on Tarek Nor for sure.
Voyager did.
I'm glad I understood you there that you said Fringe, because at first I thought you said Friends, and I thought you were going to talk about the episode when Ross was really into his music when he was in high school and he was too shy to ask Rachel out to the prom, and then we find out that he actually has been in love with her all this time. And yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Voyager did that to some extent with Living Witness, you know? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think another approach they could have taken without the techno babble would have been the approach they used for Pale Moonlight. If we could have seen Odo on that runabout acting strangely and he suddenly breaks in and tells a story, this confession, if you will, he's just overcome with the guilt of what he's experienced here at this conference and he just tells the story. Or even in his quarters, just recording a personal log, you know, he leaves the cockpit of the runabout and he goes back and he opens a personal log and tells this story. I think it would have had a similar effect that we got from Pale Moonlight, where Sisko's just recording a personal log.
Although the difference may be what you said earlier, in that when Sisko is recording that log, he deletes the log at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still kept to him. But as you said earlier, Odo's past sin is exposed to Sisko and Garrick and Dax here. And they don't forget about it. As I read the end of this episode, they don't forget about what happened. They don't forget the memories of it, because Odo doesn't forget the memories of it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. There's a report and Kira reads it. And so there is an ongoing element to this. There's a repercussion to what happened.
And he could have confessed to them, but I think that would have been out of character for Odo. It mm-hmm. was the... It took the experience of having the scab removed, the pain of removing the scab of this past indiscretion and exposing that piece of his past, I think that was so life-altering for him. He would mm-hmm. have never just... I think it would have been out of character for him to just confess it.
Since we just brought up Kira, I just want to acknowledge how effectively she's used in this episode. I mean, she's not there until the very last scene, and she has like 3 lines of dialogue, and yet it is extraordinarily powerful and basically colors the entire thing that we just saw and leaves you with a feeling of, I mean, I don't know if it's dread or what, or disappointment or whatever it is, until you get to the next episode or whenever. And I just think that's really cool that, you know, lots of times with these shows, you know, you'll see like they'll just throw in a character who's basically not used because, you know, they need to get them in there for a few minutes or whatever, you know, and then they go away and they're completely insignificant. But here she's only in that one scene, but she's integral to the episode. I think that's yeah. awesome.
And not only that, but this coupled with what I mentioned earlier about Children of Time and other things that happen along the way, they all build to that end game of the relationship between Kira and Odo and the fact that they do get together eventually. And it builds character for Kira as well, that she's able to make sense of these things over time and ultimately forgive Odo. And these little moments, again, like you said, it's just a few lines here at the end of the episode and she just appears, but yet it's a key part of the bigger picture.
Yeah, it feels like she was there the entire episode. But as I said in my initial remarks, I was a little disappointed in her reaction when she discovers the truth about this one incident regarding these 3 Bajorans. And the way she comes at Odo and in a sense judges him, he was polar opposite when he pieced things together in Necessary Evil. I thought he extended a great deal of grace, and she doesn't reciprocate. She does over time, and I think it works. But initially, I was just a little disappointed in the way she handled it. I would have expected her to respond to Odo in a similar manner in which he had responded to her in Necessary Evil.
But it's different for her this time, because in Necessary Evil, like it was a traitor, right? Like it was a Cardassian sympathizer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, these were innocent Bajorans. So it, for her, it's a completely different point of view, in that she was doing what she had to do for the justice of Bajor. And here, this person who she thought was justice and justified and you know, basically holy with the law, had an error in his persecution of these individuals, you know?
Yeah, and he says, you know, maybe I'm just a, you know, a flawed solid or something to that degree. But, you know, we established in the episode that Timor, Ishan, and Jalur, I think, were the names of the 3 Bajorans. You know, they were accused of trying to assassinate Gul Dukat. And He says, Odo says to Sisko, these three were innocent. However, no one knew that at the time. And Dukat wanted to make an example of them. So it's not as though... I don't see that there was an intention there or even a sin of omission on his part. I think he genuinely made a mistake and perhaps didn't even realize the mistake he made until after the fact. He got to apply a little critical thinking and maybe pieced some of these elements together. All along during the episode, we see him saying, you know, you need to look into this and you need to check into that. And I don't know, I've made these mistakes in life and I've gone back and kind of rethought them. And as I apply some critical thinking to the situation, I uncover things and I see things that I didn't see in the moment. And so I get that feeling about this during the course of this episode that, you know, he didn't perhaps see them as innocent in the moment, but over the course of time, after thinking about this and rehashing this, suddenly he discovers I've blown it. I've made a terrible mistake.
But it's not even over the course of time. I mean, Odo actually addresses this in the episode. 3 days later, there was another bombing.
Yeah. Right.
And they knew at that point that these three people were innocent. So he didn't really have to think about it for a long time. He realized quite quickly that he made a mistake. And the scene when he is talking to Thrax and he's explaining to Thrax that you need to go deeper. Don't just trust what your guards tell you. Do a proper investigation. That is Odo telling himself,
this is
what you should have done at the time, which goes back to the beginning of our discussion when it was asked about Thrax. And I guess, Bisha, you asked if
Thrax was
that
him.
That was really just Odo saying these were the things that Odo did and the things that he said. So it really is addressed. As far as Kira is concerned, which is what we were talking about here, I think that there are a few things that are different. She's developed this friendship with Odo, and they have growing feelings for one another at this point, even if they're kind of behind the scenes. She thinks she knows who Odo is. She's come to know him as a certain kind of person, and now she's very, very disappointed to find out that he allowed something like this to happen, because she has come to believe that he was someone who was doing his best to protect her people during the occupation. And the fact that he's known all this time that he made this mistake, but he's never, ever revealed this to her. And so I think she's just extremely disappointed and doesn't know what to think. And I actually think that this shows that she has feelings for him that are growing at this point, because I think that's one reason why she's so disappointed by it and why she has that reaction to him. If she did not have those feelings beginning to grow, she might not react so strongly, or it might not take her so long. She wouldn't be grappling, trying to figure out what to think about it 2 days after she read the report.
Well, we established early in the episode that Odo has an almost legendary kind of persona among the Bajoran people. So they all look to him as this figure, this trustworthy figure who represented everything that was good during the occupation. And I don't think that reputation has been marred by what we discovered in this episode. I think we just discovered that in the midst of everything, he made a mistake.
Right. And I think that's how most Bajorans would look at it, especially if they stop and think about it for a moment. I think that the fact that Kira reacts differently is specifically because of her relationship with Odo.
Yeah, that's a great
point. And where that's headed in her mind.
That's a great point.
Yeah. Okay, well, we are passing an hour, and there's one other thing that we should touch on before we do final thoughts, and that's Dukat in this episode. Did Dukat's behavior in this episode, the way that he was written, the things that he said, did they change your perception of Dukat in any way in the fifth season?
I don't think so, because the way that I know Dukat and stuff, like watching him talk to Dax as Leeta, quote-unquote, Leeta in the past.
Leeta, yeah, nice choice of name there, Dax.
To me, he was just trying to show her that he's this good person. Like, that's how he's always seen himself. But honestly, I think it's so that she's comfortable. And he's the kind of guy, how can I word this, where he wants the Bajorans to come to him with love.
Yeah.
Right? And so he's trying to treat Leeta as, you know, calm and be, I'm a good person, so that she'll come to love him so that he can sleep with her, right? Willingly. She'll come to him to, so he can sleep with her willingly. And so that's all that I see out of his motivation in this. And to me, that's perfectly in character with Ducat and how we've seen him the whole time and how we come to know him later on. You know, he wants them to come to him with love.
Yeah. I think he wants that in general of the entire population.
Right. The entire Bajoran population. Yeah. He wants them to come with to him with love.
And then ultimately, when they want, that's when he declares he's going to kill them all.
Yes.
Yeah. Later on in the series. I suspect he does this with many Bajoran women all the time, because they say she has been selected. I imagine that he selects women on the station frequently.
Right.
Well, we in another famous flashback episode, we see him do that with Kira's mother.
Yeah, true. Any thoughts on Ducat, Mike?
You know, I mean, I don't think that this really adds much to his character in terms of, you know, what we know him to be, you know, going forward or anything like that. I think that it's an effective use of the character, since we know who he is, and it's a nice, especially since everything is so foreign to us in this episode because of the time period and everything, to see little touchstones like you know, Ducat and Quark and stuff help to sort of ground what we're watching. And but I mean, I wasn't like surprised by any of his actions or anything like that. I think that they were appropriate to the character, but they didn't really color my perception of him anymore.
Yeah.
Such a I slimy think that character.
Lita had a good recommendation, though, that maybe you should find another job. So people keep trying to bomb you.
And but the way that he laughs in that scene, too, that is such a Ducat moment as well. Yes. You know, the way that he laughs that off, like people can say just about anything to him, and he can, you know, if it is funny, he'll laugh at it, right?
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go into final thoughts and our ratings here as we get well past an hour. So, M2, what are your final thoughts? What's your rating on this episode?
I really don't have a lot more to say about this episode than I've already said. It's got everything that makes a great Star Trek episode. It fits very well into the overall story arc. It stands alone as just a solid episode. I really dig the fact that we get to see Tarok Nor as it was before the Federation got there during the occupation. We got to experience the difference between the way things were handled when the Cardassians were in charge, as opposed to the way things were once Sisko showed up. So that was fun. And as I said before, I think it's a really fascinating moral play all the way around. The little Shakespearean things like the blood on Odo's hands, that to me just made for great storytelling. The high stakes, it's solid overall. I give this particular episode a head full of morphogenic enzymes.
Wow. Nice. All right. How about you, Biche?
I really love this episode, and I'm really glad that we sat down to do this, and I'm really thankful that, like, we got to talk about this episode so in-depth. Like, this is now going to be, I think, one of my favorite Deep Space Nine episodes. I still cannot believe that I can't remember this episode on any previous watch. Like, it was so good. And I think taking it alone added to the impact of the episode. It's not just lost in the shuffle of what's going on at the time. One thing I want to add is, what if they had aired this episode directly after Necessary Evil, right? And as they were sitting there talking, and Kira at the end, and Odo goes up to her, and he's like, why didn't you tell me about any of these things? You had all this time. And Kira's like, well, it was hard. Mm-hmm. And then she goes to him, do you have anything you want to say? And he's like, well, funny story, but there's this time when I like totally killed these three Bajorans. It was terrible, but let me tell you about it.
Or let them be killed.
Yes. Anywho, like I can't even, normally I couldn't even come up with a rating for this, because normally we come up with silly ratings, and I think to try and come up with a silly rating for this would, like, you know, belittle this absolutely awesome episode. Like, so just, you got to go and watch this thing because it's so good.
Okay. All right. I think with regard to if they had aired it right after Necessary Evil, I do think for this episode to work, especially for that final scene with Kira and Odo to work, you need that time for the relationship to grow, however.
Yes.
So it would have been a little bit difficult coming right off of Necessary Evil in season 2.
I was just being silly because he was kind of upset that she never came and told him what happened for the Unnecessary Evil storyline. And then here's 3 years later and he's like, yo, you never told me this.
So. Yeah. But I could see like if you did like back to back Tirok Nor story or something. Yeah. Okay. Well, how about you, Mike?
You know, one of the things that I kept on thinking about after watching this episode, and I think that's one of the cool things about this, is it really sticks with you, you know, probably more so than when you're actually physically watching it, is, you know, thematically, it seems very similar to one of my favorite movies, Magnolia. And, you know, one of the things that they keep on saying in that movie is, you know, we may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us. And I always... there's something about that theme which really strikes a chord with me, the idea of sort of regret. And it's like, if I would have just done this differently, everything in my life would be changed, you know, and I wish I could just go back to that one moment and do this one little thing differently. And it's really powerful, and it really makes you think about, you know, your life and everything. And I think that is very good. I would give it 3 5-minute breaks in a 12-hour workday.
Oh, wow. Very generous rating. Yeah, yeah. Like, very generous. Okay. Yeah, I don't have a lot to add about this episode that we haven't already talked about, but I think it is a really great episode. I do think it is, like you say, Biche, one of those episodes that kind of gets lost and you don't think about it until you happen across it again for the 7th time. And then you realize it's a really good episode. It's such a straightforward story, but I think it's a very powerful story about Odo's past. And yeah, I just, it's well done. It's well written. It's well shot, and it works quite well for me. So I'm going to give it 9 cases of temporal displacement. All right. Well, thanks for joining us today, guys. Before you go, tell everyone where they can find you around the interwebs and around the network. M2, why don't you go first?
Well, of course, I am one half of the Metatrex duo, along with my esteemed co-host, Zachary Fruling. I can mostly be found around Facebook on the Babel Conference. I'm also on Twitter. My handle is at cmichael1701, and on Instagram, cmichael1701.
Awesome. And Biche.
You can find me here on the network with new episodes of Melodic Treks, which is all about the music of Star Trek, as well as on many episodes of our From There to Here 50th Anniversary Rewatch. You can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella, and also at TrekFM, where I'm doing the hashtag TrekFMQOTD, which is the quote of the day. And I'm doing it with my rewatch, because I'm actually managing to do the entire 50th Anniversary Rewatch that crazy Mike Schindler put us all on. But it's been a lot of fun. You can find me on the Babel Conference as well every once in a while, talking Trek.
Awesome. And don't forget my companion to your Twitter thing, which I do from time to time, quotes out of context, where I'll hear something in a Star Trek episode and I'll just tweet that without the context and it sounds a little bit fishy. All right. Well, thanks for joining us, guys.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
Well, that was really cool talking about that episode. It's one which, you know, oftentimes gets overlooked, but it's nice to be able to sort of revisit it in depth here.
Yeah, I have to admit that I agree with Biche that I also was thinking a little bit about this being Necessary Evil, and I started watching it just like he did, and I'm like, oh no, this is the other one. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes they blend together, especially with Deep Space Nine, But they're all good. That's the thing. You got to realize with Deep Space Nine is no matter what, you're going to get a good one. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, if you'd like to share your feedback on today's show, share your thoughts with us about things past, there are many ways for you to do that. You can find us on Twitter, where our username is TrekFM. You can also find us on Facebook. Our main page is facebook.com/TrekFM. You can send us an email if you go to trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there, choose to send to a show, and choose the ready room, and that'll come right to me. You can even send me a voicemail if you'd like by going to speakpipe.com/trekfm. That's the word speak and the word pipe together, .com/trekfm, and I'd love to hear your voice. Now, if you want to join in a bigger discussion, the best place to do that is on Facebook in the Babel Conference. Mike, tell everyone really quickly about the Babel Conference.
Well, that's our listener forum where people can talk about our shows and everything like that. It's really great for the fans, I think, to be able to discuss what it is they're hearing. You know, we want these things, I think, in a lot of ways, to be the start of a discussion, not the end of it. And I certainly appreciate, you know, all of the feedback that we get and everything. And it's really a great way for our listeners to interact with us. And it's really beneficial to us as well, of course.
Yeah, it is great. It's an extension of the show. So if you heard us say something that you don't agree with, or you heard us say something that you think, yep, that was spot on, just come over there and let us know. And many other listeners will chime in, and it's just a great way to keep the ball rolling. If you're already a member, you know what to do. But if you're not, on Facebook, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field. It should come right on up in the list. It is a closed group, so you'll need to click join, and then we'll let you right on in. We just want to make sure people are actually listeners, so we don't talk about this outside of the shows themselves. So usually if you know about it, it's because you listen to the podcast. So click join, and we'll let you right on in there. I'd also like to take a quick moment to thank our associate producers here on The Ready Room, Renee Roberts, Sam Piasek, and Zachary Frueling. Zachary decided to give up his spot on the cot this week to Mike Morrison so Mike could hang out here in The Ready Room, but I really appreciate Zachary's support every week, every episode, and helping me keep the show coming to you guys. Also, thank you to Sam Piasek for his support. Relatively new associate producer here on the show, but Sam, I really appreciate everything that you do. And of course, Renee Roberts, who I tell you guys every time has been here with us on the network since almost the beginning. Huge supporter of Trek FM, and thank you so much, Renee, for all of your help. If you'd like to become an associate producer, you can do that. You can find out everything that you need to know at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We are a listener-supported network, so we need your help in keeping the shows coming, not just The Ready Room, but all the shows like Mike's show, Stage 9, and all the other shows that we have here for you. We publish 3 or 4 episodes every day, 7 days a week here at Trek FM, and it costs quite a lot of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows. You can support us through Patreon at any level that you like. Even $1 makes a big difference to us. We have different perks at different levels. You can, as I said, become an associate producer of your favorite show. You can also join us on the roundtable and talk Star Trek on mic with fellow patrons and hosts from the network. And we have our special website called Patron Zone, where we also put other content, sometimes early releases, artwork that you can download, and all sorts of other things. So if you'd like to support us here at Trek FM, again, check it out, patreon.com/trekfm. And we really thank everyone for your support. Now, Mike, if people want to find you around the network and the interwebs, of course, on your new show, Stage 9, tell people where to go.
Yeah, in addition to Stage 9, which I host with John Mills, where we talk about the people who make Star Trek, you can also find me doing From There to Here, which is our daily rewatch of the entire thing, all 729 episodes of Star Trek. So definitely check that out every morning. And you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K.
And I should also point out to everyone, Mike's previous show, Commentary Trek Stars, which he hosted with John Mills and prior to that with Max Hegel, is still on our website. It's still on iTunes. It's going to stay there, of course. There are 182 episodes of that show for you to check out. So if you get hooked on Stage 9 and you're waiting for new episodes to come out, go back to Commentary Trek Stars Episode 1 and listen straight through 182 episodes. Lots of material for you.
For sure. Yeah.
All right. Well, if you'd like to find me, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. That's my username pretty much everywhere, so you can always find me by using that. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me in the Babel Conference talking Star Trek with the listeners. You can also find me elsewhere on the network doing The Orb with Matthew Rushing, which I mentioned today. That show is exclusively about Deep Space Nine. And also I do our short news show Hyperchannel from time to time. I haven't done it much recently because of my work schedule, but I'll be doing it again at some point in the future. And if you'd like to read my writing about Star Trek, you can find that over on the official website at StarTrek.com. I have a new article coming up. Well, by the time this episode drops, it'll already be out. But you can search for my name, C. Brian Jones, again, Brian with a Y, and my articles should come up because those get pushed down over time on that website. There's a lot of content that goes up there. All right, Mike. Well, I think that's everything for today, so I'm going to wander back down to the infirmary because I really want to try one of those helmets that Bashir had everyone in. It looks like it's the future of VR, and I think if I could mount one in the train, my commutes might be a little more enjoyable.
All right, well, you have fun with that. I'm going to stick a slip of latinum in it because the ready room is done.